Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2022 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2021, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. Felice Arena is a man with a long and winding career. The writer of multiple series of novels, Sick Dudes, The Breezy Farticus Maximus, Andy Roy, Sporty Kids, and Specky McGee. And I think on Neighbours, he was torn by Natalie Imbruglia. Welcome to HNS Imagining the Past, the 2022 podcast series.
Thank you. I mean, you heard me giggling in the back there because I don't think I've heard Natalie's name for a long time, or Stick Dudes or Farticus Maximus, but thank you.
So just to start today, what was your first inkling to become a writer?
I often say it was the inner Felice, not the outer Felice. The outer Felice in my late teens, early when I wanted to be an actor, and I was an actor. That took me to the UK after acting on television here in Australia, and that took me to the UK in the early 90s. And then I found myself on stage in the West End performing. But the quiet or the inner Felice behind the scenes would often sit with himself and write stories and write his own characters and write stories. I was always attracted, Greg, to stories and storytelling, either in the form of being an actor or writing characters myself. And then that side of the writing sort of grew from there. I actually didn't tell anyone about my writing at the time. I loved writing at school, but I think the more extroverted Felice took over at that time, as it often does when you're younger and you're fearless and you can take on the world. And my writing sort of took a back seat until I submitted it to a literary agent in England while I was still performing as an actor on stage in the West End. And then the whole path changed. My life had changed. The literary agent got back and said, "This is great. I think you have a skill at writing for young people. Let's submit it to some publishers." And within 48 hours, I had an offer from two publishers in the UK.
Wow, that's amazing. So what attracted you to CYA?
It wasn't so much YA, it was probably, well, why young adult, I suppose, yes, that middle grade age of 9 to 12. I at the time I was missing Australia, and so I was in my 20s, so really any experience leading up to that was really in my teens, teens in country Victoria, or when I was younger, and I had a very sort of rich life growing up in the country, in country Victoria, riding bikes out there with my mates or swimming in irrigation channels. It was all adventure. And so for me, I thought, write what you know. And in the beginning, that's a well-known saying. I don't really do that now, of course, but in the beginning, when you're starting out as a writer, yes, you write what you know. And up at that stage, all I knew was being a teenager and then just had entered my 20s as an actor. So I think that was the answer to your question. Now I've lost track. Where am I going with this? Yeah, so, that's why I ended up writing for children, for that age group, for that demographic, 9 to 12. And the offer that I had received from the publishers in the UK was a two-book deal. They were actually surprised. The UK people, obviously it helped that I was on a TV show that they had known, but I was off that TV show for about a year or so and I was doing theatre. the TV show was, as you mentioned in your introduction, was Neighbours, and I was only on for just about a year. But a year was enough. Back then in the 90s, Neighbours was the big thing, air it twice a day. And I didn't know anyone when I got over there, by the way. They all knew my face as Marco Alessi, but I didn't know anyone. So I had to find my way in the first 6 months and realize how this whole fame thing is just fun and games, but let's get serious and see if I can carve out some sort of career either in the theater or with writing. I thought writing was at the back at that stage, and then, as I said, it came to the forefront, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Okay, so you're writing CYA, but then you've added another layer to that of writing historical fiction in CYA. What drew you to historical fiction?
It really was because of my love of travel and art, and in all the time I was either an actor or a writer, I always wanted to travel. I always wanted to explore. I was always curious. I grew up in a small country town. I loved it. I knew there was a big world out there, and I wanted to explore that. And I was drawn to finding out more about our places, and history was an extension of that. Also, when I did come back to Australia and I started writing full-time for kids, I wrote a series called Specky McGee, and that was all sports fiction at the time, wasn't that big. Not for that age group, not in Australia, but Specky really sort of filled that place at the time. And that was 11 years of my life and writing sports fiction and a lot of action movement in my stories. I thought, even just to keep things fresh for me as a writer, can I take all that action and movement I'm writing in my sports stories and place that in an historical setting or in a setting where it gets me to travel again, it gets me to explore and be curious as I was when I was younger. So that came about. Look, in the beginning, I mentioned it to a few people and they said, but you're the sports guy, right, Fleach? And I said, yeah, I don't really want to be pigeonholed as the sports guy. I love that. But to grow as a writer, for all of us, it doesn't matter what job we're doing, to evolve and to grow, we want to change things up a little bit. So that's how the historical fiction came into place for me. I decided I had gone to Italy about 10 years ago. I have relatives in Italy, of course, and I took my parents back to their hometowns or villages, and they hadn't been back since they had immigrated to Australia when they were young. And so I got to do the whole romantic Italian trip of meeting relatives and cousins I hadn't met before. And I was really in search of a story, hoping I could write first an immigration story. What came of it was hearing a story from my great uncle, my mum's uncle, who had befriended an orphan boy in a small seaside village in Sicily, and he was looked down upon, and this was all during World War II. So the battle was happening. World War II was happening in the background, but for my uncle and his friend, the battle for this poor orphan kid was just to be seen, to be acknowledged by the people in the village, because there was some stigma attached to this boy being a street kid. And I thought, that's the story. But now I have to use look into World War II in Italy. I didn't know a lot about World War II in Italy. I've read a lot about World War II in France and in England, but not in Italy. And it set me on this path of researching a story that I was curious about. So really it was just me being curious in the beginning and then evolved into a publishing deal. And before I knew it, I'm on a track of writing a historical novel. I was hooked.
What was the first hint you got of your new novel, The Unstoppable Flying Flanagan?
It was in the middle of lockdown, and we were here in Melbourne, and we could only go no longer than five. We had our 5 kilometre radius, and I live near St Kilda here. I'm walking around every day in the park. In the beginning, it was difficult to be creative at all because I just wasn't getting that stimulus to want to write or to be creative. I wasn't getting the stimulus of meeting people or going to places. People often think that being a writer, you're on your own anyway, so why was lockdown any different? But it was. And once I got over that initial shock that we were going to be in lockdown for a long time, then the thoughts started to come to me, the character started to come to me, and I was walking around the park and I met a friend of mine, and he told me about how much his daughter loved Australian rules football, and that she had really connected to my Specky McGee books, especially the character of a character in Specky called Tiger Girl, and she could really relate to that. And she always wondered, would there ever be a Tiger Girl or a female version of Specky McGee? And that was the first hint. Prior to that lockdown, I was overseas in the UK, travelling on a train from London to Scotland, and on my seat was a newspaper about an article. And in the newspaper, there was an article about women playing sport during the First World War and Second World Wars. And it talked about women playing soccer, obviously, in England and baseball in America. And I had wondered at the time, were women playing Aussie rules football or rugby in Australia during World War One, World War Two? And I totally forgot about it until this point in the lockdown when I bumped into this friend and told me about his daughter. And then I thought, oh, that's right. I was going to look into that a little more just out of my own curiosity. So I came back and I was surprised, Greg, to discover that, you know, women's sport, women playing Aussie rules football, have been doing that for a long, long time. Most people think it's a modern day thing, but it has gone back way back as 100 years ago. And I was fascinated by it. I couldn't believe that there were games in the 20s and in the 30s and 40s. The only way they could play football at the time was under the guise of charity, raise money for the troops. But for these women who were playing, they actually absolutely loved the game and they wanted to start leagues. And it was the same for women in the UK and in America. I'm not sure if you can recall, Greg, there was a movie in the early 90s called League of Their Own with Gina Davis and
Madonna. And of course, I remember. Of course.
And Madonna, I think she got through in that acting, right? She sort of
It was passable. Yes,
it was passable. Anything after that, not so much. But I do recall that was the first intro to really discussing about women's roles or roles in sport. And not just in sport, but in business as well. So that was such a pivotal time in women's movement in the 40s, especially. But also I found fascinating in the 40s, it was such a rich time, even though we had World War II and had the war on our shores here with the Pacific War. It was such a rich time for music and dance and art and song. And I really wanted to go into that as well into this book. So whilst Unstoppable Flying Flanagan is about a girl who wants to play football and it's her connection to a big brother, Patrick, who's fighting overseas, I also wanted to show what was happening in Melbourne or in Australia, what was happening in Australia in terms of culturally what was happening in terms of dances and songs and letting your hair down while all this terrible stuff was happening in the background.
Yeah, it's a really rich kind of mix of things you've got in the novel. Except for your prologue, the story is told through Maggie's third-person point of view in present tense. I'm just kind of wondering about what your process was in choosing to do it that way.
The process came about with the first historical novel I'd written a few years ago, The Boy and the Spy. I had tried various styles and then I felt that to make it feel present, obviously present tense, but to make it feel present for kids or the audience I was writing for 9 to 13-year-olds, so they wouldn't feel like it was just another boring, as I've been told, boring historical textbook. And I didn't want that at all. I wanted it to be an adventure they could feel they were a part of. I wanted them to feel as if they were looking over the shoulder of my protagonist. And I felt that writing in this style was the best way to do it. And I often, when I go into schools and visit schools, Greg, I talk to kids, I like to read from my books and bring these characters to life. And I find that read aloud performance is best done in this present tense form.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I mean, if you were trying to achieve intimacy, why did you explore using first person rather than third person?
I did, but I found to move the plot along, and because I like moving the plot along and feeling that I could set up a scene almost in a cinematic sense, I felt it was best to write in this way. And perhaps I was influenced by my acting days to write this way. I had tried first person, and I know a lot do that, but I feel the advanced readers, I wanted to make this historical, the books I was writing, I always want to make, especially historical fiction, accessible for the kids who probably normally don't read historical fiction. But for the ones who do, yes, they could have handled the first person, the more advanced readers. But when writing for this age group, you cross over so many demographics in terms that you might get an 8-year-old who's reading at 15-year-old level and vice versa. But you want to reach every student if you can. That's how I go into it, just because of the access and the feedback I get from when I visit schools right around Australia.
Yeah. I'm just wondering too, with writing for CYA, do you feel like a kind of pressure to reveal to CYA the kind of amazing possibilities of language? Like, I remember, even though it was later on at school, I remember reading Under Milkwood.
Yes,
and it just had a prof- profound effect on me. And I'm sure things that I had read earlier had as well. So are you kind of aware of that when you're writing?
We read Under Milkwood as well. And you know, I am aware of it, but you're dealing with parameters that the editor and the publisher sets upon you, you know, in terms of the word count and where, how far you can go and how deep you can go with your descriptions. I love wordplay, and I actually do a lot of the wordplay, my wordplay writing in my younger series for younger kids. But for this group, I sort of almost get straight to the point. I do play around, and there's moments where I do go on a bit just because going back to like the Under Milkwood, I'm just thinking, and of course there's no way I'm comparing myself to Dylan Thomas, my God, no. But you know what I mean? Yes, it has profound effects on me, but I'm not sure if this was the audience for me. I know there's a certain audience going back to the fact that I'm also appealing to those kids who are probably coming off the back of my sports fiction and going, oh, Felicia Arena, that's right. We read all these specky books. Oh, but what's this, a historical novel? Now, I don't want it to be intimidating for them as well. So I'm very aware of that, yeah. Mm. Coming back to your question, yes. I am aware, and I'm aware that I'm working within parameters.
I mean, given the feminist lilt of the story, did you kind of feel you were in danger of Maggie kind of overstepping the mark a bit in terms of, you know, it was almost kind of like she'd met a very young Germaine Greer brandishing a draft of the female eunuch, really? Like, do you think there's a real, are you aware that there's a danger that, of your story becoming a bit anachronistic?
Yes, but if I started worrying about that, I don't think I would have completed the story. When developing a character, yes, you have an idea initially of what the character will be, and you draw on characters, you know, on people, on real people, you know. I'm not sure if I drew on Germaine Greer, but I did feel a certain feel. I always feel, and I know it sounds a little new agey, but I do throughout, you're spending so much time with these characters and writing a book, it just doesn't happen over a weekend. When Maggie had been in my head leading up to this for about a year or so, and then again through writing the actual book, they take on their own voices, and you go in there with, well, I do, I go in there with sort of a skeleton plan and an idea and where I'm going to take my character. But in terms of what they say and when you start to develop their dialogue throughout and you're spending so much time, they take on their own personality in a sense. So I don't say, well, right, I'm going to write her as Germaine Greer. It's just whatever I'm feeling at the time of writing the book, I think that influences a writer. I know I was impacted by the lockdown and how we all were feeling a sense of fear at the time. That plays in Maggie's world and how we all had to keep going on and try to find comfort in one another or in books or in Netflix or whatever it was. That was impacting or informing how I would write at the time. But going back to your question again, I wasn't afraid of overstepping the mark. I just wanted to write, get it down first and see what character presents itself. And, you know, the great thing about you have to do that, and then the great thing about having an editor and a publisher and a copy editor, they all have their opinions as well. And I knew behind writing this book, I write about unstoppable women and unstoppable Maggie in the 40s, but the unstoppable women to bring this book together, the whole team of publishers are all female, and they and friends for years who have said, like my editor I've worked with for 20 years, we did all the Specky McGee series, and so I could I suppose I could, to use a sporting term, handball it over to her if something jumped out at her that didn't feel quite right, I was overstepping the mark.
Yeah, I mean, there are points in the novel where you kind of seem to be almost defining queer theory in that you've got the feminist, the gay and the ethnic child, kind of the marginalised, all of kind of meeting out on the margins.
You know what? That wasn't on purpose. I know it was. It really wasn't. It was, and people think, was it? I didn't want it to be tokenistic and you think you have to cover all bases. No, that was, again, that was a sort of a natural progression in terms of, okay, I have a girl who loves footy at the time, and that is not seen to be part of society of that time. It was going against the grain. her best friend Gerald, the song and music dance boy. You know, he loves dancing and tap dancing. I didn't go out and say this boy was gay or he's going to grow up to be gay. I just said this is what he loved, and he just didn't love football. Again, that was going against the grain at the time, because most boys probably would have loved their footy or billy cart, building a billy cart derby. But for Gerald, he just dreams of being in the theatre. But I thought together, these two were sort of born in the wrong time. I just happened to be in the wrong era that didn't acknowledge their interests. In terms of placing labels on them, I never went in there to say, oh, let's place a label on them.
It seemed quite true kind of representation of school to me, that, you know, people who were kind of misfits did kind of clump together.
I think that's always been the case, I think. But I was drawing on you. Are we going back to the question, Greg, where you're asking Matt in terms of the characters of Gerald and Eleanor?
Yeah.
In terms of, well, really, I was able to draw my own experiences from that. It wasn't intentional on my part to go say, let's cover all the bases now. Let's see if we have someone who's doesn't quite fit in here or fit in there to team Maggie and someone there and bring them together to cover all the bases for today's readers. No, for me, it was really trying to be true to the time, the historical time. In terms of Gerald, I wanted someone to represent theatre and music, which was so culturally rich during the 40s, and a lot of us all coming from a huge way from America and all the American soldiers that was based here. But also I was a theatre kid growing up. I mean, I didn't have the chance to be a total theatre kid, because in this country town country Victoria is all about sports. That was the number one language. Fortunately for me, I loved sports as well. So there was no peer pressure for me to then flip and tell my mates when I was playing sport or footy with them that I'm off to go to theatre now. And they were just laughing off, well, Fleach loves, he's a song and dance kind of guy. Well, let him be. But only because I was good at sport, I think they let me be. And I was able to put my love of theatre and dance and song into the character of Gerald. And, of course, for Gerald, he was kind of a misfit in the 40s, a boy loving his music at the time. He wasn't growing up in Hollywood. He was growing up in East St Kilda. And he didn't like football, which also made him an odd one out. But he made a great ally, and it makes a great ally and great friend. He's a loyal friend to Maggie, who is also, as we know, is a misfit for wanting to play football, a girl wanting to play football. And in terms of Eleanor, the Italian girl, or a girl with the Italian name, well, as we know in history, a lot of the Italians, if you had even an Italian name or German name growing up, living in the 40s in Australia, you were then placed into camps, internment camps. And I know there was one where I grew up, not too far from where I grew up, and I'd heard stories growing up about the internment camps there, the Italians that were sent there as well. Even if they were first or second generation Italians, and they sounded so Aussie like everyone else, but they had that Italian name. They were rounded up, as we know. So that was where Eleanor felt like a misfit for having dark curly hair, but having also an ethnic name.
Yeah, my last novel, Sweet Bitter Cane, was about the internment of Italian-Australian sugarcane farmers. But when I started researching it, I was surprised how many people didn't know of the internments during the war. So, yeah, you've mentioned that you knew of an internment camp that was near you. How did you find out about this?
Only through my grandparents and through growing up.
So were they interned?
No, they weren't, because my grandparents were the wave after World War II. There was huge wave of Italians and Greeks who came over in the 50s. But we had heard from the Italians who were already here that they were interned. So, and there was one, I grew up in Kyabram country, Victoria, in the Golden Valley. I think there was one near Tatura and Murchison as well. Just driving around with my grandparents or parents and say that place used to be where they rounded up all the Italians. And saying that to a kid called Felice in the 70s, I'm thinking, what could that happen again? Yeah. Well, how am I going to go if that happens again with a name like Felice Arena?
Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to be was an Italian growing up in Australia.
Yeah, my character actually ended up in Tatura. She was taken. It was based on a real person, but she was taken from far up in North Queensland to Tatura. So it was, you know, quite devastating for the family to be split up. And
That'll have to be on my list, Greg. I really would love to read that. I haven't, but I would really have to. I'm going to look for that. And I am still intrigued by that and how they got it. I mean, I've heard so many other stories, but that they were treated okay, but they just couldn't go anywhere. I mean,
I think I interviewed
the Italo-Australian historian Gianfranco Cresciani,
and he said that they, you know, I asked him outright, were these concentration camps? And he said, of course they were concentration camps, but they weren't in the sense of, you know, that we understand something like Auschwitz. You know, the conditions within the camps were quite good, but it was the psychological stuff that was going on of not knowing when you were going to be released, where people were, what was happening with your family and business, all of that kind of stuff was the really devastating stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, it is. I was talking to a friend the other day and said, you know, his grandfather, and he's of Italian, he's second generation, so his grandfather wasn't interned but had an Italian name, second last name, and he had a farm, and the Italians who were in the camp near his farm were allowed to work his farm. So he got really cheap labour, but it gave them something to do, and they all sort of spoke with one another. And exactly what you said, I think it was the psychological toll that sort of got them, in the end.
I mean, the other kind of, I think, interesting thing you've brought into the novel is, you know, how close Australia came to being invaded, which, you know, I think a lot of people know Darwin was bombed, but, you know, the stuff of the subs in Sydney Harbour and the plane over Melbourne and things like that are really not very well known.
So I was fascinated with the plane over Melbourne. I hadn't known that. And all the time going through school, I'd heard about, you know, we'd all learned about the subs in Sydney and Darwin, of course. But that wasn't revealed in my research. As I mentioned, right in the first chapter, there's a Japanese spy plane from just off the coast of Tasmania that flies over the Victorian over Melbourne, does its recce flight a week after Darwin is bombed. And I was fascinated to read that information wasn't revealed to the public, the Australian public, until well into the 50s after the war. And look, with my historical novels, as we're going back to our parameters and writing for this age group, 9 to 13-year-old, these are almost sort of like jumping points or starting points for kids who are very curious to explore a little more. And I felt that even the adults or the teaching reading these books, because these cross over, I know I'm writing for 9 to 13-year-olds, but I also like to think that an adult would enjoy it and find something else that might spark their curiosity to explore a little more into it. And I've had teachers and adults, especially with this one, with The Unstoppable Flying Flanagan, come to me and go, gee, I did not know that, especially living here in Melbourne, it's set in Melbourne, I did not know about the Capitol Theatre being a dance hall, or I didn't know that they used the MCG to station a lot of the soldiers, the American soldiers, or American soldiers played their sport, gridiron, here in the local park where I grew up here. They were based at Parkville. So it sparks conversation, right? That's the great thing about historical fiction. You get to see your neighbourhood, your environment, the place you have grown up in, a little differently now. I do now all the time. I write at the State Library in the city here. I live in the city of CBD of Melbourne, not too far on St Kilda Road. And when I go into town and I go past the Capitol Theatre now, I think of Maggie and co, and the Americans all stationed here who would go to this place to let their hair down a bit and dance the jitterbug.
So you do seem to write at and publish at quite a pace. I'm just wondering how many drafts you do for each work and what your whole process is like, you know, how many times do you have to go over things to really get them solidified?
You talk about pace. I wrote this, the first draft of The Unstoppable Flying Flanagan in 2020, and then everything sort of was suspended and put on hold publishing during 2020 and 21 when the bookstores went open or schools went open. It felt like a long time writing this book and this story, but what it did was it gave me a chance to go back a few times, and not just for second but third draft. And the character of Eleanor, the girl with the Italian name, she sort of evolved in the second, third draft. She was sort of slightly there in the first, but really She evolved, she came through in the second and the third draft. So usually an average of three drafts, to get back to your question, Greg, three drafts it takes me. But right up until it goes to the printers, we're always finding something. And it gets to a point where we're saying, are we all okay? Editor, publisher, copy editor, one more thing. I found this really interesting bit I really want to put in. And they've often had to tell me, the publishers, that's enough, Leech. That's all we can do. We got to go. And I'll still continue on just out of my own personal curiosity to read a little more. And perhaps I've reached a stage where I might have to write for adults so I can go a little deeper.
Well, that was my next question for you. Will you ever venture into an adult novel?
I often joke that when I grow up, I will, because I'm so in touch with my child self still, and going into schools keeps me young, and listening to them, listening to students and the young readers and their feedback, it just spurs me to keep going, and I enjoy it. Once I stop enjoying it, I'll think I'll stop. I keep saying that, but I've been doing this for just over 20 years now, and I just feel like I'm finding my stride. I think children's authors find their stride later in life as well if they've been doing it for so long. And the type of things I'm doing now, they really do have to interest me. I'm fortunate now that writing has become I've had a career in writing in Australia, and it has afforded me a lovely life, and that I now am in a position to say, right, what really interests me, but would cross over, really interests kids, but also would cross over to adults. So getting back to your question, I think I'm close to writing something for adults. Come back to me in a year's time and I'll let you know.
And will Flying Flanagan become a series or not?
I would love to. You see, and it all comes down to publishing these days. As you know, Greg, it's like putting out a film. It needs to be a blockbuster hit for the publishers to look back. It's doing well out there. So people, if you hear this, go out and support it, and then there might be. I often think there'd be a great spin-off. Mickey Mulligan was the paper boy and the bully to Maggie's character. And I read a lot about paperboys and the paperboy gangs during the 30s and 40s, and that was really fascinating. I thought, could it be in the same world as Unstoppable Flying Flanagan? I look at the different characters from that book and they have their own story and create it into a series. Talking about series, though, my historical novels, this marks the fourth historical middle grade novel for me, The Unstoppable Flying Flanagan, Fearless Frederick, A Great Escape, and The Boy and the Spy. And only recently, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but only recently, I will now, exclusive to you, a US publisher has picked them up. To be published next year. And they're all standalone novels, but the US publisher could see that they go together as a series, you know, to publish them all together. So that I'm excited the fact that I might this time next year be able to visit American students and kids and talk to them about history and about my books.
Yeah, congratulations. That's an
Thank
amazing
you.
Achievement.
Thank you.
How do you feel about the evolution of the ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. Anything that raises the profile is wonderful, but especially in children's books that don't get a lot of the airtime, especially for literary awards like this. And a lot of the times writing an historical novel, it doesn't matter if you're writing for adults or kids, it's a tough task. So you're acknowledging that. That award acknowledges that and doesn't say, well, writing for adults is tougher and they should be acknowledged more than the children's authors. Also, the children's awards out there are sort of children's choice awards. They're also, they focus on the commercial, I suppose. I want historical fiction to be commercial, and that's what this award does. It sort of raises the profile and it says to booksellers, kids want to read. They want to read. They want to find. They're curious. Yes, they love the commercial heavy illustrated textbooks, adventures, and I've written books like that. But they also want to, what about for the young reader who wants to find out a little bit about more about their world? And I've found that even when I speak to teachers, they've often said to me, we've had kids who have read all the graphic novels right up until about grade six, and when they get to high school, they don't know how to read an actual novel without illustrations. And I find there's something missing there. So I hope that my books and other books like these are stepping stones for those kids as well. So an award like this, raises the profile, but also lets the booksellers and the gatekeepers know, look, kids enjoy this, they love this. Let's shine a light, a bigger light on it as well. And that's what you're doing, you're shining a light on all the hard work and all the hard research that goes into creating an enjoyable historical adventure.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today. I have to ask you this before we finish, though. Are you related to the arena?
No, I'm not related to the arena. Maybe some have asked that arena, are you related to that other arena, the Ryder Arena? I'm not. We have crossed paths in the time because of my acting past. We had crossed paths in the 90s and even after that, and we've often smiled at the fact that perhaps our ancestors were cousins on a farm in Sicily. Yes, but I'm not legal.
Okay, sei veramente simpaticissimo.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2022 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive where you'll find interviews with many alumni. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction, including details of the announcement of the 2022 ARA Historical Novel Prize on the 20th of October, 2022. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.